those of you just coming in, there's some handouts on that chair over there if you'd like to grab one on the way in. And those who may have come from this way, there's still a few down on the front. If you'd like to, feel free just to come up and get those. Well, welcome this afternoon. Is that loud? Okay, we're just a little loud. How's that? We're still just a little loud. I'm looking out here, spending a little time trying to see if my mom's here. Mom, are you here? I can tell so many more stories if she's not. Oh, no, she's here. Okay, let me mark out a few of those. It's good to see you. Having dinner together, I hope. Good. Our hometown is just an hour and a half from here, Neosho, Missouri. It's where I was born and raised and graduated from high school, and mom and dad still live there. It seems to me like the last several years, most of the times I've been asked to go speak places, I have been given topics that were leaning a little bit into controversy. And when Terry called this year and gave me some different topics, I said, you know what I'd really like to do is just come talk about parenting. The controversial things I have a little passion about and know probably not much about. Parenting I have even more passion for and probably know even less about. But I did want to come talk about that. And so I thank you for joining me in this session. We're talking about 8-track parents in a CD world. There is a cartoon that I love of this woman who's trying to look completely elegant. By the way, how's the sound now? Still a little too loud. If we can turn it down just a little. How about in back? Are you guys okay? Is it? They're okay in back, so right about there. If I start shouting, go like this to me. I'll put this down a little. In the cartoon, the woman is elegantly dressed. She's trying to impress all the people at this dinner engagement because it's for her business. She's trying to make it into the business world. And there she is, trying to give a power posture. She's holding a cup of coffee. She has her finger just holding it just right. She's trying to make her point. But unbeknownst to her, the band on her slip has broken, and her slip is down around her ankles. And the caption at the bottom says, "Confidence is what you have before you understand the situation." And I think that's probably true about parenting. Confidence in parenting is what you have before you understand it. Charlie Shedd, years ago, did a lesson on parenting. And he said that over the years, as he represented this, it kind of went through an evolution, depending on the age of his kids. In the beginning, the title of the series was How to Raise Your Kids Right. And he spoke authoritatively, had no doubts, everything was just right. But the next time he came around, he had kids, and he was a little bumfuzzled about it. So the title of the series was Some Suggestions for Raising Children. And then they got a little bit older, and he renamed it Feeble Hints for Fellow Strugglers. And then the next time they were teenagers, and he called it Parenting, an Open Forum. I think everybody here knows that feeling, that the older your kids get, the less you know about it. I have my kids, my boys are ages 15 and 4, and I've got them to remind me that I don't have that much to tell you today. The image, the title, we just dropped down. Now can you hear, is that about right? Okay, I don't feel like I'm drowning myself out now. This actually feels normal. With a 15-year-old and a 4-year-old, I've got this ongoing sense that I am an 8-track parent in a CD world. I have to get their advice if I want to know something on the computer, at least the 15-year-old. They have constant reminders that some days my fashion is not as good as other days. In fact, recently, it was a Wednesday night, I was going and I would be speaking at church, and the 15-year-old was giving me a hard time about how I looked, letting me know that it was a little out-fashioned, a little out-moded. I didn't really belong. He was a little embarrassed to be my son, you know, little things like that. And I thought, this from a kid who has started sleeping on the floor in a sleeping bag so he doesn't have to make his bed. You know, take it with a grain of salt. And the four-year-old then, on the way to church, he said, Daddy, you look funny. And I thought, now this is way over the line. This from a kid whose view of high fashion is a Superman cape and Barney underwear, you know. I don't need that from them. But my guess is everybody here who is a parent has had that feeling that you don't quite have it together. Irma Bombeck, the greatest of all theologians, wrote one time, "The family. We were a strange little band of characters trudging through life, sharing diseases and toothpaste, coveting one another's desserts, hiding shampoo, borrowing money, locking each other out of our rooms, inflicting pain and kissing to heal it in the same instant, loving, laughing, defending, and trying to figure out the common thread that bound us all together. Sitting there, I thought about how the years have challenged families in a way no one would have thought it possible to survive. They've weathered combinations of step, foster, single, adoptive, surrogate, frozen embryo, and sperm bank. They've multiplied, divided, extended, and banded into communes. They've been assaulted by technology, battered by sexual revolutions, and confused by role reversals, but they're still here and playing to a full house." Isn't that a great piece? She says, "Home is the place where your older son will walk in the door, look you right in the eye, and ask if anybody's home. Only at home would that happen," she said. "Home is the place where your husband keeps coming in to check on dinner, tasting it along the way. He tastes something, he says, 'Hey, this is terrific, what is it?' And she says, 'It's chicken, bacon bits, kidneys, and onions.' And he says, 'What do you call it?' And she says, 'I call it the dog's dinner. We're having beans and franks. Go get washed up.'" There's something about family that can spotlight everything in you that's not exactly pieced together like it should be. I love the story the guy Dowd tells of the man, the businessman, who had no ears. Now, I'm not saying he was deaf. I'm saying he just had no ears. And he was trying to hire somebody to a new job. And he wanted to see how sensitive they were. So every time they'd come in, he'd put them through the interview. And one person did really well. And at the end he said, "I want to ask you something about me. Is there anything different about me you notice?" And the man said, "Well, yeah, you've got no ears." And he said, "Well, you know, that's right, but that's not very sensitive. I need an employee who's more sensitive than that." Somebody else came in, went through the whole routine, and at the end he said, "Anything about me you notice?" And the man said, "Well, yeah, you've got no ears." And he said, "Yeah, that's true, but not very sensitive." Finally, somebody else came in, went through a great interview, and at the end he asked the same question, "Anything about me you notice that's different?" Looked up and down and said, "Why, yeah, you wear contacts." And he said, "Well, that's right, but how'd you know?" He said, "Well, you can't wear glasses, you got no ears." I think family is that place that has the ability to look and spot all of those little blemishes. Recently, my four-year-old was with some of his soccer buddies, and they were bragging about dads. "My dad's this, and my dad's that, and my dad's that." Christopher wanted to go one up on them all, and he said, "My dad's got a hole in his head." You know, I don't know what the thought was there. You know, he can scratch his brain if he wants or something, but they can spotlight that. Well, what I want to do is talk about 8-track parents. Even though I am kind of an 8-track dad, maybe sometimes a cassette dad in a CD world, I want to slice out these 8 tracks, and today and tomorrow and the next day, kind of run down what those tracks are and the implications for parenting. I hope everybody has a handout. Does anybody here need a handout? Now, we're not talking about money here. We're talking about... Just feel free to come up here. There are a bunch right over here on this side of the stage. If somebody from your area would come get some. I think there's maybe still a few on that chair back there if somebody in that corner needs one. The first track is that we are dispensers of grace. We are dispensers of grace. Now, there are several different ways you can picture this. You might picture a battery recharger. A battery recharger where our kids are going into a cold, uncaring world. There's some more in that box if anybody needs some more. The kids go out into a cold world. A technological jungle. It's hard-hitting, it's fast-paced, and it leaves them exhausted at the end of the day. Dad comes home tired, mom comes home tired, the kids come home tired. Everybody comes home and they're tired. So whose job is it to recharge the batteries? Don't say mom. It's mom and dad's. It's the parents' responsibility. They're the ones who are there to recharge the batteries. Or another word picture might be the security blanket. That we are the ones who are there for our children to wrap around them. To let them know that they're safe and secure. Another picture might be the filling station. That our kids come in with low self-esteem. They've just about depleted everything. And there we are pumping it in, trying to fill up the tank so that they can just go on. We're the security blanket. We're the battery recharger. We're the filling station for our children. It's an amazing thing to see a 19-year-old co-ed at a college as she stops and she thinks back to her family, remembering the hugs and the smiles and the words of encouragement. It's an awesome thing to think of a 25-year-old as he holds his first child in his hands and he thinks back longingly to his own mom and dad and the way he was nurtured. I just heard a man talk about how the whole time his daughter was growing up, every night he'd put her in bed and he would say to her, "If they lined up every little girl in the world and let me pick one, I'd pick you." He told her that when she was born and when she was one and two and three and four and then when she was in middle school and in high school so that she rolled her eyes like, "Daddy." But somehow he could tell she still liked it. A high school girl, and he's still tucking her in bed, saying, "Honey, if they lined up every little girl in the world and let me pick one, I'd choose you." Last Father's Day, he said, now she's on the West Coast, she's going to a college out there. It's far away, his life had been ruined, and he got a Father's Day card from her. And on the front, she'd written, "If they lined up every daddy in the world, dot, dot, dot." And he said he just melted. He melted because he knew that she was a long way away and he couldn't tuck her in bed anymore. But he knew that every night she went to bed hearing the voice of her father saying, "If they lined up every little girl in the world, I choose you." Corrie Ten Boom had a great memory when she was going through the Holocaust. As she sat in those awful places with her sister, as they looked out while they were in the showers and saw those ogling eyes of the Nazi soldiers. And then they went back to their ratty beds. She said, "My security was assured in many ways as a child. Every night I'd go to the door of my room in my nightie and call out, 'Papa, I'm ready for bed.' He'd come to my room and pray with me before I went to sleep. I can always remember that he took time with us and would tuck the blankets around my shoulders very carefully with his uncharacteristic precision. And then he'd put his hand gently on my face and say, 'Sleep well, Corrie. I love you.' I would be very, very still because I thought that if I moved, I might somehow lose the touch of his hand. I wanted to feel that hand until I fell asleep. Many years later, in a concentration camp in Germany, I sometimes remember the feeling of my father's hand on my face. When I was lying beside Betsy, my sister, on a wretched, dirty mattress in that dehumanizing prison, I would say, 'Oh, Lord, let me feel your hand upon me. May I creep in the shadow of your wings.'" And it was in the midst of that suffering that my Heavenly Father's security was present. I love the image of parents who are dispensers of grace, who let the kids know that there is a safe place, a place where you're going to be loved and embraced and recharged and filled back up. But now let me tell you the problem. If you're taking notes, just write out on the margin Genesis 3 and you can read it all later. The problem is that we live in a curse-filled world. We're not in paradise anymore. God created us in paradise so that we would know that there's only one place to find life, and that's from God. You know why the Bible's making such a big deal out of idolatry? Not that you're tempted to go to Baal or some other statue. Idolatry isn't just Baal. Idolatry is anyone or anything from whom you try to find life. Now, it's not Baal in my congregation, but you know there's some spouses in my church that think that the person they're married to ought to be able to give them life. There's some people that think the church ought to be able to give them life, and maybe if they have kids, that'll give them life, and if they have better careers, that'll give them life. Something out there, if they could just get a little bit more of something, then they would have life. And then the church aggravates it because we get people married and we tell them, "Here's the key to marriage. You take care of her needs and you take care of his needs." And we complicate the curse. You don't make marriages better by telling them that they can fill each other's needs. You make them worse. You re-emphasize the curse. The best thing we can tell the families in our church is not that you can fill one another's needs. The best thing we can say is your needs can be met only by God. Don't try to get out of a human being what they cannot give you. My wife can love me and serve me, and I can love Diane and serve her, but I can't fill her deepest needs. I can't give her life. And if I try to, I'm helping her commit idolatry. But the same thing then passes on into parenting. In Genesis chapter 3, the curse is that we're going to try to find life by getting our value from performance. For example, the woman, her desire will be for her husband. Now that's all out of whack. Her desire ought to ultimately be for God, not for her husband. But in this performance-based world, her value is coming from performance. His value is coming from his job. He's going to toil and toil and try to find life by climbing some kind of ladder. It's curse-filled. And then very subtly, unintentionally, we send messages to our kids. You will be accepted if you do this. Or you'll be accepted especially if you do this. Here are the things you need to do in order to be accepted around here. Just do this or do this or do this. And if you'll do that, if you'll make straight A's or if you'll make the football team or if you'll come home on time, if you'll do something around here, then you'll be accepted. And that complicates and passes on the curse. And it's how they are every place they turn. In school, they're to give grades and they work for scholarships. And in relationships, they know that they're based somehow on a curve. And in activities, they hear slogans like, second place is the first loser. Every place they turn, it's performance-based. And so you have families where you nag and plead and manipulate and bribe and bargain and yell and hit and threaten and quote Bible verses and quietly sulk. And I promise I know some of you who come to hear me this afternoon know better than I know what I'm talking about because you grew up in families like that. You grew up in performance-based families that didn't dispense grace. They dispensed a string and there was something always attached to it. You can be accepted around here if. And so what happens is you produce a child that in the middle is empty. There's a big hole inside here that's empty. But nobody wants to look empty. Everybody wants to look full. And if the child has peers who are doing good things, that child will do good things. All kinds of positive things. Go to church. Go to training seminars. Maybe come to the Tulsa Soul Winning Workshop. Go to youth devotionals. Go to summer camp. They're doing all kinds of good things. Maybe then some of them will go to a Christian college. Or they'll go to another college and be part of that group there, the campus ministry group. And somebody looks at them and they say, man, that kid, that's one of the best kids in our church. The problem is, they look full on the outside, but on the inside they're empty. They're learning by religion to get their strokes by performance. And every time this kid reads scripture at church and somebody says, man, you are really good, it strokes him one more time. He's still empty on the inside. It doesn't take care of that. But there's a positive sign on the outside and he feels good temporarily. And I would challenge you to think of our youth groups not just as people who look full on the outside, but some of them full on the outside and desperately, deathly empty on the inside. The church, unfortunately, sometimes re-emphasizes that just by affirming the outside. Now, if you take another child, this child gets into negative peer group settings. These kids are stealing and cheating and getting drunk and driving drunk and all of that. Well, they're going to do whatever it takes to get strokes and affirmation there, so they fall into all the negative behaviors. So they look empty on the outside, and they're empty on the inside. But now let me ask you, while the church is happy to have those that look full on the outside, which of those true is more of, those two is more of a time bomb waiting to explode? It's the ones with the cognitive dissonance, where they look like everything's great on the outside, but inside, they're empty. I've preached for the last 13 years at churches by Christian college campuses, by Harding and now by Abilene Christian. And what I've seen happen is that you have a guy come who's like this. He's empty on the inside, but he's full on the outside. And he's so desperately empty that he's looking for a girl who can fill his needs. So he goes out and he finds this girl on campus and she looks full. And he thinks, yes, finally I found somebody that can save me. But guess what's true about her? She's empty on the inside and full on the outside. She's in the same performance track. She still has found a way to be accepted if you stroke her needs. If you tell her she's good, if you tell her she's beautiful, if you tell her she's smart, if you tell her all those things. So she's worked and worked and worked and worked, and her value is high at times, but at nights it's not very high. You want to know why so many girls on Christian college campuses are struggling with bulimia? It's because they live in a curse-filled world. It's because they're convinced that on the outside they've got to look a certain way and act a certain way and behave, and everything's got to be just like the world says. And if it's not, then they'll do everything, including kill themselves. So they're attracted to one another. They get married, and everybody's all excited. She's excited because she found this spiritual guy who will meet her deepest needs. And he's all excited because he's felt bad about himself all these years. And he's met this wonderful girl who's so spiritual, and she's going to take care of his life. And now they're married, and a year later they're mad. Why are they mad? Because that person didn't do what I thought they would do. That person didn't make me well. That person didn't fill my life. And you know why? They can't fill your life. They're not capable of it. Only God can fill your life. But then the church aggravates them and says, oh, yes, you can. Yes, you can. You can fill her life. You can fill his life. Here's what you need to do to fill his life and meet his needs. And here's what you need to do to fill her life and meet her needs. And the curse is complicated. So the number one thing I want to say about parenting, the very first track is that we are dispensers of grace. We are here in our families to say, kids, you will be judged everywhere you go in this world, but when you come here, when you walk in this door, you will not be judged. Luke 15 is the picture of the home. The child has done everything in the world wrong, but when he or she comes home, there are the father's arms open wide. You're loved here not because you're doing things right. You're loved here because you are my son. Because you're my daughter. God said to his own son, you are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. And that's the message we've got to get to our kids. First of all, more than anything else, if there's some youth ministers here or some family ministers here, the number one thing I'd want you to take back and teach your parents to say to your kids is that you are special to me. You don't have to do anything around me. You don't have to bat 400 on the Little League team. You don't have to make the All-Stars. You don't have to make straight A's at school. I want you to do all you can and achieve as much as you can. But the moment you walk in this door, you are fully received and accepted because I love you. They lined up all the little boys in the world. And let me pick one. I would pick you. And so we learn to affirm, we learn to tell them that this is a safe place, that you're fully loved, that you are a unique, special person, and that only God can fill you. The most important message I can give my two boys is, Daddy can't give you life, Mama can't give you life, there's no friend out there that can give you life, only God can give you life. That is the number one message I must give to my kids. Nothing else begins to compare. And so we become creative about how we communicate that. What's the proper way to do that? I'd heard somebody say this was a good way. So a couple years ago, when my son, I think, was in sixth grade, the older son, I wrote a little note and I slipped it into his lunchbox. And the note said, have a good day. I love you, Dad. You know, I knew he'd get to school in the middle of the day, he'd pull out his lunch and there'd be this note from me, and I knew that'd make him feel special. And he came home that night and he said, Dad, I got your note. Don't ever do that again. What if somebody saw that? You know, my whole reputation in this life is at stake. It was a couple summers ago. Diane and I were going overseas. I was going to do some speaking. And that meant Mom had the boys. But we had to leave right at the end of the Little League season, but right before they announced All-Stars. And the way my older son is wired, that was just everything to him. And so after we left, All-Stars were announced. We were overseas. We were in Europe. And he made All-Stars in baseball, and he opened this letter from me that said, congratulations, I knew you'd make All-Stars. And then a letter about how proud I was of him, but how I didn't want him ever to base his own view of himself on whether or not he makes All-Stars. Reminded him that his sister, before she died, was mentally retarded. Fully loved by us, fully loved by God, a messenger of God in this world. And so we can't judge based on intelligence and athletic ability. Just wanted to remind him of that. What he didn't know is that my mom had another letter that he'll never see. And don't give him this tape, because I didn't know whether he'd make it or not. The other letter said, "I hate that you didn't make All-Stars. You should have." And that's all that was different. The rest was just the same letter. You know, just a cut and paste. Because whether he made it or not, I want him to know, number one, you're special to me. And our relationship doesn't go up or down based on whether you are this or that, straight A's or making All-Star team. And number two, that I cannot give you life. Only God can give you life. And folks, that's the message that's got to be communicated. That's the number one thing. We've got to be dispensers of grace. We've got to let them know that we are not shaming. We are not expecting. We are there just to receive them and welcome them. Let's go to number two. I goofed. I thought these classes were an hour, and I read my packet when I got here, and they're not. So we'll have to fast forward some. Number two, the second track of parenting is that we are brokers of time. The home is supposed to be a service station where kids can pull up and we take care of them. But that illustration assumes that somebody is there at the service station and that they're in the servicing business. But some fatal assumptions have been made, especially with this generation we call Generation X. And the assumptions were, A, that divorce won't hurt them. B, that child care could do the same as parents could do. And C, that schools can teach the same values that we would teach at home. And so this track of parenting is that we are brokers of time. The big debate back in the 70s was, so which is it? Is it quality time or quantity time? How many of you remember that debate? And you remember the final answer? The answer to that is quality time, and lots of it. You've heard that. It's not an either or. Part of the way I dispense grace to my boys is that I spend time with them. That's the only way a kid knows that you do care. Let me talk for a minute about how time provides nurturing for children. Number one, it establishes the child's importance. It tells them, you matter to me. I'm really busy, and you know I'm busy, but I'm not so busy, but what? I can't have time with you. There's a movie this past year. Michelle Pfeiffer is in it. She's at this important business dinner. She's trying to make an impression. She's trying to make it in a man's world. She's trying to sell herself. Her boss is there by her, and she's trying to shoot this deal, this advertising deal, to this high-flying customer. And she keeps looking out the window. She's in this posh restaurant, and outside the window is her son telling her, it's time for my soccer game. And so she's fast-forwarding through her pitch. She's giving everything she can. Finally, she gets up in tears, and she says, I'm sorry, I'm leaving. And they're both these men are aghast. They're saying, where are you going? She says, I'm going to a soccer game. And she said, I want you to know that if I was the kind of person who stayed here today and missed my son's soccer game, I would not be the kind of person you need on this account. But the fact that I'm willing to walk out on you and my career and everything I've been building toward to go watch that little kid play soccer probably says that I'm the kind of person you need to do this job. And she was gone. And these two men are sitting there. Their eyes are rolling around. The client turns to the boss and says, I like her. I think how many times... Incidentally, I hope I don't come off as the hero in my illustrations. I'll try to give some to balance because I've blown it probably more times than I've done right. But one thing I think I've done fairly well is I don't miss many games. I don't miss many practices. I've taken that red eye special from the West Coast so that I can get there on Saturday morning to coach soccer. I love soccer. My 4-year-old is in the under 6 soccer. Isn't that the best it ever gets? It is the best. He's got a 2 o'clock game in the afternoon. 8 o'clock, he's fully dressed. He's sitting there waiting. What time now? Is it time yet? It doesn't get any better than that. His first year in Searcy, the older one, I coached soccer. I said to them, I want you to know, I don't know. I said, listen to me carefully. I don't know anything about soccer. I know nothing about soccer. And they said, we'll take you. So I was the soccer coach. And you know what? That first year, it doesn't matter, does it? It absolutely doesn't matter. It's just this little hovel of kids all over the field. Kicking the ball, kicking one another, doing whatever. They don't care. And at the end, they're all jumping up and down. They're all jumping up and down. They don't care who won. It was fun playing. What was bad was when I got asked to coach again the next year. And I reminded them, do you remember me telling you, I don't know anything about soccer? Well, I want you to know, I didn't learn anything about soccer. But I coach. And to this day, I think I may be the only coach ever to scream at a soccer ref, how could you be offsides in soccer? Well, guess what? You can be. I didn't know. I told him I didn't know anything about soccer. I know a dad in Searcy teaches at Harding University. Big departmental retreat. You're not supposed to miss this retreat. He missed the retreat. His daughter was leading cheers at a ball game, and he told him, I don't miss that. Sorry. Teaching establishes the child's importance. Number two, spending time together permits bonding. Those are the places that you grow with one another. That was the tragedy of Harry Chapin's song, Cats in the Cradle, which you remember. The little boy's tugging on Dad, saying, come on, Dad, let's play. And Dad's too busy. He's moving. He's on the run. And then it reverses. Now the son has grown up, and he's got this busy job, and his dad's older. And his dad's saying, come on, son, let's play. And the son's saying, sorry, Dad. They miss that important time of bonding. As you take a walk, as you practice piano lessons, as you play ball, as you sing songs, as you read Cat in the Hat for the 1,000,000th time, as you wrestle and as you make cookies, lives are being welded together. It matters. It matters. There are a lot of people at the Highland Church that I want to save. A lot of people I want to minister to. There are hundreds of college students I want to help. But I tell you what, if it comes down to those two boys and those hundreds of college students, I'm out of there. Somebody else can take care of them as much as I love them. I want to be with those boys. A third thing spending time does, it allows for modeling. It lets them see how you behave in certain situations. And sometimes when you've blown it, I've had to go in at night sometimes and say, Matt, you remember how I reacted when Mom said da-da-da-da-da? That was a good example of how I don't want you to act when you're married someday. I'm not proud of it. I blew it. I'm sorry. But that was modeling. The modeling that says this is the way you look, this is the way you live. Robert Schuller, after one of the books he wrote, went on this big whirlwind tour like he'd been doing lately. He was in 14 cities in 1 week, signing books and giving speeches and so on. He came back home to the Crystal Cathedral, found out that they'd had a big raffle. They were raffling off, and the number one prize was lunch with Robert Schuller. And he thought, oh boy, one more thing to do. So he went home, and he got all ready. He came back, anxious to find out who had spent $500 for lunch with Robert Schuller. And imagine his own expression when he found out that his teenage daughter had spent every dime she had to bid on lunch with Robert Schuller. He said that was the last whirlwind tour for a while. Spending time together gives us this time to grow and model and bond. So where do we find the time? Let me give you the ABCs. If you're jotting this down, you can put it. I know I didn't give you much space in here, but you can use the back, and I know you can just memorize things as I go. Here are the ABCs. A is allot the time. Just allot it. Put it in your schedule. Be proactive. The same thing some of you guys at church have got to do. I have to do that. First of the week, I have to schedule in everything that week. Because you know what? People in church think the daytimer is sacred. they're neutral about the Bible, but they know the daytimer is sacred. And if they come to me and say, Mike, could I come in and see you Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock? If I say, I'm sorry, my son's got a game, they don't understand that. But if I pop open my daytimer and say, I'm sorry, I have something scheduled then, that's holy ground. Pastor Mike is busy. We can't walk on his schedule. I didn't tell them what I was doing. I didn't lie to them. I beat them to my schedule. If I wait, they're going to beat me and I'll be full day and night. But I mark out, this is family night. Monday nights now, that's baseball night for the Abilene High School baseball team. I don't do things on Monday night. You allot the time. You do it proactively on the front end. Here's B. B is bring your kids in on your activities. Guys, we're bad about this. We want to go do something on Saturday and we forget we could take the kids with us. You want to go fishing? Take the kids fishing once in a while. You want to play a round of golf? Take the kids with you to play golf. You want to go to the library? Take them to the library and read to them. I have great memories of my dad taking me to Kiwanis Club. I don't ever remember anybody else's dad or any other dads having kids there with them, but I remember many times going to Kiwanis Club with my dad in Neosho, Missouri, and him proudly standing and introducing me. Now, maybe that happens to everybody, but I tell you, that made me feel like I was incredibly important. He was going to go to Kiwanis, so every once in a while he'd say, come on. It didn't cost him an extra minute, but it felt to me like it was time crafted for me. Even some of the chores that can be done around the house, I found out it really makes a difference in the time the chores take if you'll include your kids. Right now, the four-year-old loves to wash the car with me, and it makes a difference in time. We can get done in 90 minutes what would have taken 20 without him. But I want him there. Incidentally, just as a sidebar, if anybody here knows the answer to this dilemma, I'd like to know, why is it that a kid's interest in helping you is oppositely proportional to their ability to help you? I got a four-year-old who's dying to mow the yard. He's ready. It's March. It's Abilene. It's time to mow. And he's got his little toy lawnmower out there ready to mow. Well, he's mowing in front, beside. I have to watch throwing stones and so on. The 15-year-old who can lift 220 pounds bench press has absolutely no interest in mowing our lawn. And he and his friend Chad have Matt and Chad's lawn service. That was B. Bring the kids in on your activities. Here's C. Capitalize on the time you do have. My wife is a stickler. She's a legalist about TV time at mealtime. It almost doesn't matter what's on. We don't watch any TV when the family's sitting down. There are a couple exemptions. The Super Bowl, if the Cowboys are in it. What? Certain Final Four games, if Carolina or Arkansas is in it. You know, there are certain exemptions, but there are only a couple or three every year. But she's a legalist about that. We've got this time together. We're going to feed our faces. So why don't we look one another eyeball to eyeball and talk while we're at it? Well, tomorrow I'm going to lead us on through these other six. If you'd write down number three, bearers of pain. Because of my little time goof, I may or may not get to that one. I'm not going to start there tomorrow. We may circle back Saturday if I have some time. These eight tracks, we are dispensers of grace. We are brokers of time. We are bearers of pain. Tomorrow, I'll keep building on that. I hope you'll be able to join me. This is stuff I feel passionate about. I didn't want to talk about controversial stuff. I want to talk about stuff that's more important than that to me. I want to talk about my kids and your kids and the kids in your church and how God has wired us and given us gifts so that we can instill the kind of faith in them that they need. Thank you so much for coming. Tomorrow morning, hope you can rejoin me. Thank you.